This is Jesse Zurawell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Before I introduce my guest, I'd just like to say, with reference to the commercial you just heard, do not join the military. There's nothing glorious about the military. It is all about death and the worst of the human spirit. So that said, I'd like to welcome back to the program Dr. Marwa Osman. Marwa is a journalist, a university lecturer, a political commentator, and host of the program Midi Stream on Press TV. She is joining me live from Beirut. Marwa, how are you?
Hey, Jesse, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I want to dive right into what's been happening in Palestine over the past week or so. It hasn't been getting much coverage in corporate media, and it hasn't been getting much coverage in independent media either. I'd like to start from the beginning, if you will, of this latest, well, stage of the war between the resistance and the Zionist occupation entity, otherwise known as Israel. I'd like to start from the beginning and lay out that timeline and talk about why there is a lot of significance to what's happening from the perspective of the resistance this time around. So where would you start the clock here?
Well, basically, I'd begin with what happened at the beginning of this week when the Israeli entity assassinated a Palestinian Islamic Jihad leader. And the Islamic Jihad, for those who don't know, there are a lot of Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip, all across Palestine for that matter, but in the besieged Gaza Strip, there are a lot of different Palestinian factions like Hamas, like the Islamic Jihad, like Azdin al-Qassam. There are a lot of brigades that work together. They have a joint room, operations room, that they work together whenever they have an aggression against Palestinians going on in Gaza. They work together and they launch missiles by coordinating with one another. What happened is a few days back, at the beginning of this week, we had the Zionist entity assassinate one of the Islamic Jihad leaders. They just bombed his place and killed him, and killed with him a number of civilians as well. So what happened is the Islamic Jihad obviously retaliated. I mean, you're being attacked. The least that you could do is defend yourself. And that's exactly what happened. And when the resistance retaliated, we had the typical Israeli death jets started bombing civilian areas, killing children and women and elderly in Gaza. We saw, all of us, we saw the photos and the videos of the funeral processions of Lina and of the little baby Qaddou. It's beyond horrific, the videos that we saw and the images that we saw and the families that were annihilated with bombs falling on their heads in their supposedly safest place they could be, which is their home, because they cannot flee, because Gaza is the biggest open air prison on earth. They're besieged from every place. So that's exactly what happened in the past week. But for three consecutive days, we saw that the resistance was capable of retaliating. More than 1,000 rockets and missiles were launched from Gaza into the Palestinian occupied territory, especially in what the Israelis call Tel Aviv, what we call Yaffa, and into other occupied cities as well. Now, the Israelis were obviously trying to test the capabilities of isolating the resistance factions, because they were targeting specifically the Islamic Jihad, because they wanted to see if other factions would take part or not. But the issue is, the Islamic Jihad did not even ask for the help of other parties, because, as I said, when I started, they have a joint operations room and the Islamic Jihad issued a statement by its Secretary General Nakhale, by its director, and Nakhale said that if we wanted our friends and our brothers to get involved, we would have asked them to, but there was no need for it because we were covering the area by ourselves. So, but the Israelis, from the Israeli side, they were trying to see if they can isolate the movement and possibly deal what in what they believe a devastating blow to the Islamic Jihad and probably pave the way to eliminate it. They were reacting to it the same way they reacted in Lebanon 2006. They thought that they could eliminate Hezbollah, and this is the same strategy that they used against the Islamic Jihad. But obviously, their calculations were proved to be wrong, and their ambitions were futile in Gaza. And the Islamic Jihad was steadfast. It showed efficiency. It showed readiness to go into a longer battle. I mean, it was the resistance that was continuing. I mean, the Israelis were the ones who asked the Egyptian side to mediate for a ceasefire, because what they said is that their goals were met. But obviously, their goals were not met. Assassinating a leader is not a goal. Their goal was to annihilate and to eliminate the Islamic Jihad, and it was proven to them that that would be impossible to do. So that was what happened in Gaza. But at the same time, as Gaza was happening, we also saw the assassination and the martyrdom of Ibrahim Nabulsi, one of the young youth leaders in the occupied West Bank, who was murdered by the Israeli entity, but who proudly did not give in, and he fell a martyr while fighting against the Zionist entity. And Ibrahim was one of the most wanted resistance fighters for the Israeli entity, and they were never able to detain him. He went fighting till the last breath, and they killed a couple of other young men as well. And clashes are still ongoing in several areas in the occupied West Bank, especially in Nablus and in Jenin. And I'm pretty sure that we're not going to see any end to the ongoing confrontation with the Zionist entity, because it's basically what the Islamic Jihad was referring to. The battle of the Islamic Jihad was entitled The Unity of Battlefields, and they were insinuating that this battlefield that's going on in Gaza is in one. It's serene, and it's in harmony with what's going on in the West Bank, in the occupied Al-Quds, in Jenin City, in Nablus, in other parts of the occupied West Bank. So it's synchronized, coordinated unity, basically. So what we are witnessing right now is multiple fronts, multiple battlefields with one goal, and one goal in specific: the liberation of Palestine, one democratic Palestinian state.
Yes. So that was one of the, you pointed out there, one of the very significant things about this, about the resistance hitting back, the coordination, not just among the resistance factions in Gaza, but the resistance factions in Gaza with those in the West Bank. The young man who was martyred in the West Bank, was he a member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade?
Yes. Ibrahim Nabulsi was one of the young men. He was 19 years old. If you see that man, you would think that he's at least 40 because of the battlefields that he's gone through, because of the experience that he has gained, but he was only 19. And to understand how that was possible, you need to see the mother. Oh my God, Jesse, if you followed his mother, what she was saying, how she was reacting, how she held her own son on her shoulders. She wouldn't accept anyone else to hold the coffin. She was there to hold the coffin on her shoulders, along with the young men who were the friends, the resistance friends of Ibrahim. I mean, when you listen to that woman talking and how she was reacting, you would understand why Ibrahim was such an important figure in the resistance in the West Bank. And it's beyond amazing, because he's an icon now, and a lot of the Palestinian youth there, they look at him as an iconic figure of resistance. And I think that he's going to be an inspiration. He is an inspiration to hundreds of thousands of Arab youth, but in specifically in the West Bank. I think his blood will not go in vain, and I think that they will retaliate to the assassination of their very good friend and leader.
Mm-hmm. I want to just put in perspective, because, or put in context, the civilian loss among Palestinians, simply because even in independent media, this tends to get reported in estimates. And it's always boggled my mind how we can know down to the very person how many Israelis have been killed, or in Ukraine, how many Ukrainians have been killed. But when it comes to Palestinians, when it comes to Lebanese, when it comes to Syrians, we can somehow never get the exact number of dead, the exact number of casualties. So the last I was able to ascertain was that approximately 50 civilians have been killed so far, including 16 children. Is that where the count stands as of now?
Well, the issue is you can get the numbers clearly from the website of the Palestinian Health Ministry, because they put them, they update them minute by minute. So the right. count that you is it's near the estimates, but the Palestinian Health Ministry is always on top of these things, and you can always get the right numbers from there. But when it comes to the Western mainstream media, Jesse, I mean, it's obvious. I mean, we don't need to do the comparison of what happened in Ukraine versus what has been happening in Yemen, or what happened in Ukraine versus what has been happening in Palestine since 1937 and not 48, since the 30s mm-hmm. and not the 40s. Because a lot of massacres happened even before the so-called announcement of the Zionist entity. But we could analyze it, the reasons behind this, the psychological reasons and the political reasons and the military reasons. But I mean, it's obvious. It's the North versus the South. It's the colonial powers versus the colonized. It's the white versus the brown or the black. It's the same story that has been on for as long as humans can remember. There's always been an open war between, basically, it's not a war, it's an aggression, actually, from the Western world against the global South. Because if you go to the global South, they all have stories of independence battles with colonialism, especially European colonialism, and later on U.S. colonialism. They all have stories, they all have martyrs, they have heroes, they have movements, they have a history written with blood and mm-hmm. and liberty movements. And when you go to the northern part of the world, you see museums and history, which is basically stolen history. I mean, their museums are stolen artifacts and historic not only artifacts, even stories and pyramids and poles, and stolen from the southern part of the world, because it was the colonial mm-hmm. power that was maintaining its power on the global South and basically putting its hand on its wealth and its history. So it's been like as long as we can remember. But the issue with Palestine in specific is because of the Zionist entity. I mean, if you go to the UN Security Council or the human rights organizations, especially the one that are affiliated with the UN, you can see that there are hundreds of resolutions and hundreds of drafted bills and drafted documents that pinpoint the Israeli entity as a criminal. And mm-hmm. The only states that usually bail out on such resolutions or put a veto on such resolutions are the usual colonial powers, the US, the UK, and a number of European, former European colonial powers. Or I don't know if we can say former. I mean, France is still a colonial power. It's stealing most of the African yes. resources. So it's basically the same group.
Well, it's trying, of states. It's trying to be, but it's failing miserably.
Yes, but especially in Palestine, because when we talk about the numbers or the incidents or the horrifying tragedies that go in Palestine that go under the radar in the West, no one knows about, or even if they know about it, the titles get played with. I mean, they usually say clashes or casualties, or they don't say that Israelis bombed and killed kids. They don't use right. these headlines. I mean, an Israeli took an F-16 jet plane, went over in the sky of Gaza, bombed buildings, killed humans. That's what's happening. They twist the story, and it's a whole school of twisting, to be honest with you. It's a whole school of journalism based on twisting facts for the sake of Western narrative, Western interests, Western colonialism, and Western hegemony. So that's basically it. If it were any other country or entity other than the Zionist entity, you would have seen it with red character generators and flashes on news flashes on Western media like there's no tomorrow. But because it's Israel, I mean, you could take an example of any other incident that happens across the world, and you can see how the Western world reports about it, and the Western mainstream media reports about it versus what goes on in Palestine. I mean, for Yemen, there was a complete blackout because Saudi Arabia was basically buying the media, paying for it. But you could see that sometimes certain reports will infiltrate the mainstream media. Why? Because the payments would be delayed, or the payments did not come. And then you could see in the media suddenly an article talking about how Mohammed bin Salman is a developer. A developer is a liberal leader. He wants to change Saudi Arabia for the better. And then you read in a new article that he is the Satan of Saudi Arabia. That the newest article, I think it was on The Economist, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was on The Economist. I don't know if you saw. Yeah. So it's just
read that.
A game for them.
I read that on let me see. It wasn't on The Economist. It was on Al-Ahed, the Lebanese outlet. They republished it.
Republished it, yeah. But it was on a major mainstream media outlet.
Yeah, it was published. It was from The Economist. Yes.
Yeah, it was from The Economist. And to be honest with you, I was the cover photo of the magazine for that story was very insulting because they used the agal, which means they used the piece of clothes that Arabs usually wear, the kafia that they wear on their head. It's actually insulting to all Arabs to use this. And I think that if I remember correctly, they put on the kafia something like a bomb or something that's really violent, that insinuates violence. And this is an insult for all Arabs. We don't care. You can diss Mohammed bin Salman all you want, but they have certain cultural disintegrity and disrespect to a whole new level. I mean,
yes.
I don't know if I would give you an example. Like if you want to talk about a certain Scottish personality and you put the Scottish skirt, which is the traditional men costume in Scotland, and you would insinuate or you would reflect that it equals violence, you're actually disrespecting an entire nation. For the agal, for the piece of clothes that men put on their head in the Arab world, this is worn by the entire Arab world historically, not by Saudis. So it was also disrespectful at the same time. But this tells a lot about how the Western mainstream media operates. They're basically trying to take a bribe from Mohammed bin Salman. I mean, they're basically telling him, yo, pay us some more and you'll not see such reports on our magazine. And
right.
I think Mohammed bin Salman, for a large part of his position in power, he fell for it because we saw him making trips to Silicon Valley multiple times and having a lot of meetings with the social media giants and a lot of mainstream media outlets as well in New York, as just like in California. So the man paid thousands and thousands of millions of dollars to try and buy a good position for Saudi Arabia. But Israel is different. They don't have to buy it because Israel is an extension of the Western colonialism in West Asia. So it's part of them. It is a Western piece of regime built and planted in our region to be the center point of the entire region to make decisions for the region to be the hegemonic power of the region and to put its arm and control over the wealth and resources of the region and to control the decision-making process as well, as we have seen through the normalization deals that happened throughout the past 4 years. So with Israel, it's different than with Saudi Arabia. It's totally different. Mm-hmm. Israel is part, historically, part of the West, politically an extension of the U.S., and militarily is just basically the military base for the EU/U.S. Army.
Yes. Yes, I often refer to Israel as a garrison state of the U.S. An outpost of the U.S. But I'm looking at the article we just referenced, which was originally published by The Economist and republished mm-hmm. by the Lebanese news outlet Al-Ahed, and it's titled MBS Despot in the Desert. And the image you just spoke about is a cartoon, and it's a shot of what's supposed to be MBS from the back, from his shoulders.
Yeah, he's wearing he's wearing the aigal. I just opened it right now, and there's a small, like, his aigal is a bomb or a TNT finger.
There's a fuse attached to it that's lit, a very short fuse, which there's a lot you can read into there, and I think you would be correct
to very disrespectful.
To read into that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So that's a perfect example of the.
But again, I couldn't care less what they write about Mohammed bin Salman, because we've been talking about this psychotic persona for so many years now. But the way that they portray it is always something that's racist or that's disrespectful to an entire nation of, I think we are 1 billion Muslims in the Arab world. I think we are about 500 million Arabs, so that's disrespectful to 500 million people. So yeah,
it's either done intentionally or they're too stupid at The Economist to know.
I think it's the second.
yeah, I agree. So we need to throw it to a quick break, but there is more I'd like to get into with regard to what's been happening in Palestine and specifically how the resistance has been fighting back, because there are a lot more interesting aspects we can and should get into. So everybody hang tight, and I'll be back with Marwa Osman here on TNT Radio after this.
TNT Radio's Joseph Arthur.
Pelosi tiptoed around the issue of U.S.-China relations Friday as she wrapped up her swing through Asia, knocking Beijing's human rights record before insisting in the next breath that America had to work with its superpower rival. I have said it again and again. If we do not speak out for human rights in China because of commercial interest, we lose all moral authority to speak out about human rights any place in the world, she told reporters during a news conference. Well, statements like this certainly don't calm the situation between these big junkyard dog nations, and they're probably not meant to. Whatever righteous explanations she can make about her reasons for going to Taiwan, they cannot really justify the minefield we have now stepped in as a nation. It all just seems an unnecessary complication. You pick your battles, and we can hardly justify being world police with our country in the state that it's in. Claiming a moral high ground strikes me like a bit much. And the way that it's going, we don't have the resources on any level to really contend with this right now. Spiritually, mentally, physically, financially. Chaos closing in on every angle and at every level.
Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
A man's home is his castle, but his men's shed, that's his kingdom. There are now more than 1,000 men's sheds across Australia. And they're more than just a shed. You can make things, grow things, find a mate, be a mate, shoulder to shoulder. The Australian Men's Shed Association can help to find a shed near you.
There's something for you at the Men's Shed.
Close your eyes and think about this. Imagine taking your child to school where all the other kids have access to textbooks, paper, and pencils. but your child is only allowed to listen. Would you be okay with that? That's what it means to be blind. For every 100 books a sighted child can access, a blind child has access to less than 5. Help put the world at the fingertips of vision-impaired kids. Donate now at braillehouse.org.au.
Where progress is influenced by revolution and evolution. This is today's News Talk Radio. TNT. TNT.
Welcome back to Perspective here on TNT Radio. Just a quick reminder, we are live 24/7. You can find us on your preferred streaming platform, whether that be Apple, Google Play, Spotify, all of the big ones. We are on there. We are also on Rumble and YouTube. In addition, you can download our app from your preferred app store, and you can visit us at our website, tntradio.live, where, of course, you can find us live around the clock and listen to back episodes. You can also do that on all of the other platforms I mentioned. I'm Jesse Zerwell, and I am speaking with Dr. Marwa Osman. And we've been discussing the Palestinian resistance fighting back against Israel's latest attempt to, as Marwa put it, test the resistance's capability, is how she put it earlier in our conversation. So, Marwa, getting back to that, the cradle.co, the website, on August 6th, published a very good piece by Abdel Bari Atwan titled Sword of Jerusalem 2, or Saif al-Quds, has begun and there is no room for negotiation. And the sub-headline reads, Israel may have miscalculated again. The PIJ, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, resistance has brutally targeted in Gaza and the West Bank. It has brutally targeted in Gaza and the West Bank, wants to take this confrontation until the liberation of Palestine. So for the resistance, what this article points out, among many other things, for the resistance, they have no intention of seeking mediation or a ceasefire. They are willing to go all the way until the liberation of Palestine, as Abdel Bari Atwan puts it. And I think that's a huge development. I wouldn't say that it's new or out of nowhere. I think it's been growing for quite some time, but it is quite amazing to see this playing out on the ground.
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree. And look, the issue is when, even if you read about it on a daily basis, it's not like living through it. And I say that from experience, despite the fact that I was a kid when Lebanon was liberated, when South Lebanon was liberated. But I remember it very well. I was in 2000, I was 11 years old, and we used to go to my father's village because it was not occupied. But it was like that village and then one village behind it. And that's it. The line of the occupation is drawn and you cannot go inside. And we could hear the bombings happening when the resistance would be doing its missions and operations against the Zionist entity. We could hear everything. And then we could hear how the jet planes would come and bomb certain areas within the occupied territories. So when you live through it, and I never had the chance to go through an Israeli checkpoint to my occupied village, but a lot of my friends and a lot of my relatives did. And when they tell us about it, because at that time I was not living in Lebanon with my family, but when my relatives tell us about it and how denigrating and disrespectful and dehumanizing it is, it's different than when we see it in photographs and videos. I mean, you could just Google Israeli checkpoints in the West Bank and or in Al-Quds in Jerusalem, and you could see how they basically treat the Palestinians as if they are a bunch of livestock. You can Google how livestock live in farms and then Google how Palestinians are treated at the checkpoints in Al-Quds. And it's practically the same. So this was happening also in Lebanon. And the administrative detention that was going on, the imprisonment of civilians, basically simply for saying no to the occupation. We had several detention centers, especially in Khiam, the village that I'm talking to you right now from, which is on the border with occupied Palestine. We had a big detention center in Khiam. It's called Al-Khiam Prison or Al-Khiam Detention Center, which Israel bombed in 2006 to try to erase evidence of its inhumane, disastrous behavior towards the detainees. But when you live through it, you could understand and you could basically fully comprehend how this development occurred, how events followed one another until liberation happened. Because anyone living outside Lebanon or inside Lebanon for that matter, but away from the occupied territories, would have never in a million years thought that these territories would be liberated, because they're not there. Mm-hmm. They don't know how the resistance is operating. We know how the resistance is operating, and yet we could never comprehend how it could be possible. Why? Because we have been fed and brainwashed throughout our entire life that Israel is an has an army that is undefeatable, that it's the toughest entity in the region, that no one can stand in its face. But then Lebanon got liberated. Lebanon went through war with it and was victorious in it because of its resistance. And then we saw Saif al-Quds, and we saw the first intifada, the second intifada. We saw Saif al-Quds, we saw the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, and how people stood their ground and did not accept for the occupation to take their homes and to take their streets. And then we saw that Jenin, despite the fact that in 92 the occupation invaded Jenin and carpet bombed it, eliminated entire neighborhoods in Jenin. And then again we see that the young kids who lost their parents and their homes in Jenin in 1992 grew up to become resistance fighters, to retaliate. And you see Jenin again is the birthplace of resistance fighters in the West Bank. Up until now, the occupation cannot freely meddle or freely roam in Jenin because it's full of resistance fighters. The same thing in Nablus, the same thing in Lod. Even in 1948 territories, we would have never thought in a million years that we can see active operations happening inside of what the Western world knows as Israeli cities when they are Palestinian-occupied cities. Because the 1948 Arab-Palestinians never forgot their origin and never forgot that their parents and their ancestors were killed, massacred by the Haganah terrorist gangs who came from all over Europe to basically usurp the Palestinian land. So it's when you see how the entire Palestinian map is lit with protests, confrontations, clashes, missiles, you see that it's practically and realistically a unified battleground. And that after 74 years, this entity still did not find it a solid foundation for its institutions and for its illegal colonial settlers to reside, quote, peacefully, end quote. Because you cannot live in a peaceful swath of land when you are terrorizing everyone around you. It's not going to happen. I mean, people, they have an innate reflex reaction to retaliate and to fight back. I mean, I don't know if they would understand that, but those who normalize ties with Israel could never understand it and could always be in shock when this happens, because they are so far away from all the tragic happenings that were going on in Palestine. But those of us who went through it, they have a firm belief that Palestine will be liberated.
Yes. Yes. As to those Arab states that have normalized quote unquote relations with Israel, to me it seems they are motivated first and foremost and perhaps solely by finance, by what they can get financially from not just their fellow normalizing Arab states, but from the West and Israel as well. There's a lot of money and a lot of favors to be received in normalizing, again, in quotes, relations with Israel. And it points to the fact that these countries, not the people in the countries, but those who presume to be their rightful leaders, are willing to sell out all of their principles, if need be, to gain any kind of financial advantage or financial gain for their governments or their monarchies. That's how I see it. They have no principles.
It doesn't have to be financial. By the way, it doesn't have to be any gains. They are happy by maintaining their positions and the power. That's it. Because they know that the Western world, they know that the U.S. can, with a click of a finger, organize a coup in any of these states if they dare say no.
Right.
So it's as simple as that.
Right. So I want to ask about Hamas's role in what's happening, because so far it's been, I wouldn't say inactive. It's certainly, I believe, playing a part, but a very calculated part, and has not come out to
this
say
this is what
that
the Israelis. Yeah, but this is what the Israelis would want us to talk about, because they want it to propagate in the media that, look, Hamas did not respond. Hamas doesn't want war. But I told you there's a joint operations room in Gaza, and even Hamas issued a statement saying so, that whenever our brothers in the Islamic Jihad want us to take part, we will take part. If they say that they need us, we'll be there. The exact same thing happened in May, I don't want to say the wrong month because it's been multiple times. I mean, but not so long ago, we did see not only in Saif al-Quds, even this past year, we saw certain skirmishes that happened between Hamas and the Zionist Israeli entity. And they said that we don't need the help of our brothers. If we will need it, we will ask them for it, because it's the tactics that the resistance is working with. You know, you have different political factions. You have different political and military factions, resistance factions in Gaza. They coordinate with one another, but at the same time, they have their own detainees within the Israeli detention centers. They have different objectives, but at the end of the day, their goal is one: the liberation of Palestine. So there are certain calculations that each Palestinian factions would want to raise in the face of the occupation. So at this moment, the Israelis are in a very bad shape politically. Their political system came into a deadlock. And they are trying to use the Palestinians as, if you want, blood cards to help certain Israeli parties win on other parties for the upcoming elections that's going to happen. So for them, it's very important to say that, look, Hamas did not engage because we were able to deter Hamas. But that's a lie. No, they were not able to deter Hamas. They were not able to deter Islamic Jihad. And if the Islamic Jihad needed the help of Hamas, they would have asked for it, and Hamas would have given help as needed. But Islamic Jihad leader was assassinated, and the Islamic Jihad retaliated as they should.
Right, right. I'm certainly not suggesting the Israeli lie that Hamas was somehow put in its place here or refuse to respond. I don't think that is the case at all. And it's provably not the case. I just bring it up because in the Cradle article I referenced, there's an interesting paragraph that reads, "The most frequent question asked in the West Bank and Gaza Strip today is, where are Abu Ubaidah, Mohammed Daif, and Yahya al-Sinwar, in reference to the military spokesman of Hamas's al-Qassam brigades."
Yeah. Well, the issue is, it's not that it's not their battle, but it's basically an Islamic Jihad leader was assassinated. So the center stage should be taken by the Islamic Jihad, and this is exactly what happened. But those who are asking this question, I'm sorry to say, are either a bit ignorant of how the ways are operated or how things are operated within the different Islamic factions or the different resistance factions in Palestine, or they are playing into the hands of the Zionists without them knowing it. I mean, none of the people that I trust and I support in Palestine actually ask this question. The people who are asking these questions were, you could have like regular, maybe uneducated or not very well knowledgeable people who might ask this, but at the end of the day, those who matter and those who make the decisions for the resistances, for the different resistance factions in Palestine, knew exactly where Hamas was and knew exactly where Abu Ubaidah was and Sinwar was. And they don't need to prove that they are with the resistance because they are the people of Gaza. They are the people of the world. They are Palestinians within their own brothers and sisters. They need, I mean, for example, I give you a direct example. In the past wars that happened between the Zionist entity and Lebanon, on several occasions, the Zionist entity would attempt to assassinate and actually assassinate leaders in the Amal movement in Lebanon, despite the fact that the Amal movement stopped direct confrontation with the Zionist entity in the early 90s, not because they wanted to, but because they weren't getting the necessary and needed logistics and weaponry, for that matter, to fight. But Hezbollah was getting the necessary tools that it needs to become the most powerful resistance faction in the region of West Asia. But at the same time, the Israelis did not forget about the leaders of Amal movement who were fierce fighters against Zionism in the 80s, especially when Israel invaded Beirut in 1982. So they kept assassinating them. And when they did, it was Amal movement who would send fighters to fire Katyusha missiles, for example, on the Zionist entity. It was not Hezbollah who would retaliate, but Hezbollah would issue a statement saying that, first of all, we send our condolences to our brothers and sisters in the Amal movement, and we are ready to be in their support if they ever need us. This is how resistance factions operate, because it's not one unified army. It's different resistance factions with different affiliations, but with the same goal. The same goal in Lebanon was to liberate South Lebanon, as it happened. And the same thing is for the occupied territories in Palestine. I mean, look, in the elections that happened, the last elections that happened in Gaza, it was Hamas who won the elections, but Fatah wouldn't accept it. But at the end of the day, Fatah movement has its own fighters, Hamas has its own fighters, and they all work for the one goal of liberating Palestine. They obviously have different opinions concerning internal Palestinian issues, and this is what democracy is about. But at the end of the day, in the face of the enemy, they share the same goal, which is the liberation of their land.
Yes, that's a very good point. And that's been my position as well. So I found it interesting that this paragraph posed these questions, because I'm familiar with the complexity of the coordination that you just described, but it's often presented, the resistance in Palestine is often presented in a monolithic way, as if there's only one entity, or there are many entities, but there's one that's directing all of them. And that's not the case. It's the opposite, if anything. So I wanted to point that out. But Israel has certainly been dealt a huge blow. I think it doesn't know what it's gotten into. Its Iron Dome, its celebrated Iron Dome, failed miserably in stopping the rockets that came in to the part of occupied Palestine called Israel, these retaliatory rockets, these rockets fired in self-defense. And I think that it's the Israeli entity is scrambling right now. And its days look numbered to me. So that's a good thing, because it means, as we've been talking about, the liberation of Palestine, the end of a colonialist entity that has been long been a garrison state of U.S. empire, of Western empire. We need to take one more quick break, but when we come back, I want to ask you a little bit about Lebanon, because there's a lot happening there as well that is not unrelated to what we've been talking about in Palestine. So once again, everybody hang tight, and I'll be right back with Dr. Marwa Osman here on TNT Radio after this.
We're saved. A professor has found the root cause of climate change. And you guessed it, white supremacy. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio. Stay tuned.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Dr. Jacqueline Gill of the University of Maine has now claimed that, quote, the root causes of climate change are capitalism, white supremacy, colonialism. Gill is an associate professor of paleoecology and plant ecology at the University of Maine. If Dr. Gill is correct, the only solution is for the whole world to go Marxist. Yes, that's right. Give up your freedoms, your rights, and listen to the centrally planned economy. But here's the catch. Even if we give up all our freedoms to fight the alleged climate crisis, the weather and climate will not notice. This professor joins two NASA scientists in claiming the same thing, that white supremacy is a driver of climate change. Yes, all a day's work in the wacky world of climate. For the Morano Minute, this is Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing. Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
At age 30, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, you can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Who is Klaus Schwab, and what is the World Economic Forum which he leads? Klaus Schwab, the chairman of the World Economic Forum, believes transhumanization is a fundamental part of the Great Reset within the Fourth Industrial Revolution. He states, the difference of this Fourth Industrial Revolution is it doesn't change what you are doing. It changes you if you take genetic editing just as an example. It's you who are changed, and of course this has a big impact on your identity.
Get breaking news on your phone when it happens. Download our app from the Google Play and App Store now.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zerwell, and I am speaking with Dr. Marwa Osman, who is joining me from Lebanon. So, Marwa, I'd like to ask you a few things about Lebanon, because economically, energy-wise, it's still in very dire straits. So there is an offer by Iran to provide free fuel to Lebanon, which desperately needs it. And this is being held up by the Lebanese prime minister designate, even though Lebanon's energy minister, Walid Fayyad, is ready to get this deal finalized. At the same time, Iraq has agreed to provide Lebanon with fuel for another year. And there is the ongoing battle, I would say, for Lebanon to reclaim control of the Karish gas field, which Israel has taken over, has captured, and is looting. And with regard to Karish, there's one thing I very much want to point out, because there is often talk about China standing up to Western empire. If you go to Energean, the entity, the Greek company that is providing the infrastructure for Israel to loot this gas field, if you go to their website, it reads, first steel was cut on the FPSE, which is part of their infrastructure, in Costco Yard in Zhoushan, China, on November 26, 2018. Energy Power FPSO hull sailed away from the Costco Yard in China on April 3, 2020. The hull arrived in Singapore on April 15, 2020. So we have to note here that China is helping to provide the infrastructure to Israel to loot Lebanese gas. We can't overlook that, as much as it might complicate what we want to think about China fighting back against empire. It is aiding and abetting.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't complicate. It doesn't complicate, because if you also look at the security agencies, basically the spying Israeli agencies, you can see that there are a lot of agreements that were forged with China, between the Israeli entity and China. I know we have a lot of problems with the Chinese foreign policy concerning Palestine, but I think it needs a bit of time for it to clear up. But at the end of the day, China would have to make a decision between the Zionist entity and the peoples of this region. But at the same time, I have to point out that this so-called Greek company is not a Greek company, because apparently it's a Zionist company, but it's initiated in Greece. So the founders and the owners of Energene are actually Zionists, and they're not of Greek nationality. So it's more of a, like opening an offshore company to take advantage of certain maybe documents, or maybe certain political issues that usually Israelis would face would have to face hardships with, because despite normalization, there are still a lot of Arab countries and a lot of Islamic countries around the world that don't normalize with Israel. But if you have a company that use, like if it's a company whose headquarters is in Greece, pretending to be a Greek company, that it would be much easier. But that's not the main issue here. The main issue here, I'll start from the end, not to talk about the Iranian oil now. I'll start from the most important event that's going on, because we are at very, very tense times in Lebanon now. We have the upcoming 10 days are decisive. The upcoming 10 days will either start a war with the Zionist entity, or reach not an agreement, but a mediated sort of deal between Lebanon and the occupation, mediated by the American envoy, Hochstein.
Yeah, Amos.
And I think, yes, and I think that there will be no agreement. And now, wherever you go in Lebanon, the primary subject that everyone is talking about is what will happen when the war starts, and not if. So we're talking about now days. And anything can happen. Literally anything can happen, because Hezbollah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, has been threatening wildly the Zionist entity with everything. And they did send, we all watched the video when they sent the drones to the Karish offshore gas field, and Israel went crazy. Israel went crazy when that happened. And
my favorite part of that, when that took place, was that Israel said, we took down the drone at the most strategic time. And when you watch the footage from the drone, it's essentially hovering right over one of these offshore platforms. So yeah, it seems to me more like you took it out when at the very last possible second you realized, oh wow, it's that close.
And by the way, they took down two. The third one was not taken down. The third one, it went to a point where its battery went dead. So they were able to take two out of three. And we don't know if it's actually only three that went, because they were able to get to bring down two. But we don't know how many actually were sent.
Right. So Marwa, let me just say that we have about 30 seconds left, unfortunately. And I'd love to get into more of this with you.
Just keep a wide eye for Lebanon because the upcoming 10 days are very important.
Yes. Yes, definitely. And I really hope that something can be figured out to get this much needed energy to Lebanon very, very soon, because the economy hopefully. And the economy in Lebanon is devastated is a way to put it mildly. Yeah. Inflation is through the roof.
Our only option is to get our gas.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So Dr. Marwa Osman, host of MidiStream on Press TV, I very much appreciate your time and insights as always.
My pleasure.
And I look forward to speaking again soon. Please stay safe. Bye-bye. And be well. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
And that is it for me on Perspective. I'll be back at the same time on Monday. Have a good weekend, everybody.